All right, cool. So, Sam, if you want to, so everybody in the group is familiar with the article and a little bit of your background. What the group is, Robbie and I have built like a men's lifestyle company that'll be creating content. We have a bunch of moderators, guys sign up. We have, you know, some hedge fund managers, athlete dudes, guys who are good with women, some career coaching guys. And it's basically, effectively, imagine Ask Men, but the subscription model. Questions are then answered, sourced, and packaged into content. And so that is sort of what Robbie and I, it's more about our businesses and what we do. So we've had, we've interviewed a bunch of interesting people over the last year and a half, and I've had some interesting stuff come from that. I posted in the group, hey, do you guys want me to do an interview with Sam Paul? Will you make a donation if I do his thing? And, you know, if X number of people said yes, great, I do it. A bunch of people said I'm in. Would love to have a call. So they'll be posting questions as we're doing the interview.
Great.
You can talk about grocery ships as much as you like. And then I posted a link. I posted a link in there so they can go donate as well.
Excellent. Thank you.
So do you want to give your background, your story? I guess my primary question, which can probably, at least not primary, but the question I have that can lead you from how you got to where you were in your early 20s is, it doesn't seem like you come from a necessarily overly educated family or career-driven family. Where did the desire, et cetera, come from to even enter into banking? How did you have the foresight, you know, to follow through and be willing to put in that kind of work? To get ahead, a lot of my hedge fund buddies, you know, they come from that pedigree. They weren't necessarily middle-class guys that got into it. They didn't understand what was necessary to get there. When I spoke to Michael about you a few weeks ago, he said that from the day you showed up, you were just a really hungry dude that would do whatever you had to do.
Yeah, I sort of think about, like, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with, like, the book, the Great Gatsby, but, like, how they found at the end of that Jay Gatsby's sort of like, you know, notebook from his childhood, and he had listed like all these things for kind of self-improvement and self-work. And I definitely was like that. I mean, I always had something inside of me that was sort of pushing me for more and more and to get better and better. You know, first of all, my family was sort of lower middle class. They were college educated. So my dad went to NYU. My mom went to, Northern Arizona State or University, and then she became a nurse, so she went to Vanderbilt Nursing School. But what we had is, like, my dad really had these huge dreams, so he was always talking about when he would sell a screenplay or when he would start a business and sell it for $1 million, and, you know, he was kind of always living in this fantasy of the future. But the reality was sort of different than that. Like, we were, you know, we weren't, you know, destitute or poor, but we were, like, living in rented houses, going paycheck to paycheck. You know, you couldn't order Cokes at restaurants because it cost too much. So there was always sort of financial stress, always just overwhelming our lives. And then the other part of my dad that I really do think is pertinent is that, and both my parents actually had these crazy tempers. So, you know, they would, you know, they could go from really nice and, you know, like anybody, they're not sort of all bad or all monsters, but they could quickly go from, you know, kind of placid, happy, laughing to exploding with fury. And, you know, when my dad would lose it in particular, he would get this sort of look on his face that, you know, first of all, I knew I was in for like a beating, but not even, it wasn't really the physical stuff that was so bad. What it was this look on his face that was like, it literally felt like he was saying, I hate you, you know? And so I really believe from like an early age, I got the message in like a lot of different ways that, that I was sort of worthless and, that I was more of a burden than anything. And so I learned pretty quickly not to ask for money. You know, it quickly became a point of pride to make my own money and never ask for anything. And so I had this sort of big chip on my shoulder about that, but I think that that's sort of what went into this sort of desire to sort of push myself at all costs, because first of all, I was so desperate to prove that I was valuable, but beyond that, I actually also didn't treat myself like I was valuable, because that was my sort of underlying belief. And so I'll give you an example. Like, in high school wrestling, you know, I came into high school a really heavy kid. I was 210 pounds as a freshman, and
wow.
And then I lost a bunch of weight and started wrestling my sophomore year, and I started wrestling at 171 pounds, then I dropped to 160 and stayed there for 2 years, and then my senior year I dropped down to 152 pounds, and it kept getting harder and harder to make it, you know, the lower I got, obviously, but I loved the fact that I could wrestle smaller guys, so I had a better chance, and I felt like I was bigger than them. And so for senior year, the last tournament possible, because you had to cut by a certain time before you made it to state at a certain weight class, so I cut down to 145 pounds, and that meant that day cutting 15 pounds in a single day. And, you know, I tell you that not because I think it's like the greatest thing. Actually, the next year, my first year in college, 3 kids died. This kid from the University of Michigan, and then 2 guys from smaller schools. And so they changed all the wrestling rules. So now there's dehydration tests and whatnot. But, you know, I literally cut 15 pounds by, you know, wearing plastics and wrestling in a wrestling room and going for runs in plastics, and also then spending hours and hours and hours in a sauna. And it was so painful, but I was just so willing to do it just so I could win.
And you won the match.
I did win the match.
How'd you fare?
Like, I did. It was like a dual match. So the kid was.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
But I like, and I was up like 10-0, and then I gassed, and so like I barely won it. And it was honestly the last round of that match was the hardest 2 minutes of my life.
All right. So now that took you in. I'm in high school. I'm guessing you were a 4.2-4.3 GPA student.
No, actually, if you can believe it, I was a 3.3 GPA student.
How in the world did you get into an Ivy League school? Did you get a wrestling scholarship?
It was sort of crazy. It was like, you know, I was a good wrestler, but not great and by any means. But what I did do is, like, I have an identical twin brother, and him and I mean, this just shows you sort of how hungry we both were. We would, every day after school in the off season of wrestling, because our program wasn't so good, we would drive an hour down to East LA and work out with the kids at Schur High School, which was number 5 in the state, and, you know, all Mexican, the toughest program anywhere close to where we were. And so we just trained with those guys, and they actually asked us to come wrestle for them, and we didn't, but we ended up becoming friends with the coach, who was an Olympian, who knew the Columbia coach, who talked to him, and so sort of sight unseen, and the truth was that I wasn't good enough to be a Division I wrestler. I was sort of, you know, the next step down. I would have been probably an okay Division III wrestler, and but we got on that list, and that being on that wrestling roster, and the fact that I had really good SAT scores, help me get in.
Oh, well, that's pretty. So that seems, so you sort of luck sacked or jumped your way through 2 big holes, meaning 3.3 GPA and your first job out of school, right?
Yeah.
Get you pretty fortunate events along the path.
Yeah, absolutely.
And now college, that was the end of your drug use career. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, I started, you know, I had done some drugs before college, but in college, that first year, I mean, my freshman year was the most miserable time that I have ever been through, and I was so lonely, and I started drinking every day, going to the bars, then I started smoking pot, and very quickly, it was like pot turned into ecstasy, turned into Ritalin and Adderall and cocaine, and then, you know, I started dating girls that dealt pills, and then it was just off to the races, and so I ended up, like I said in the article, committing a burglary of a guy I'd been in a drug dealing partnership with that went bad. And so I got caught doing that. And so I was kicked out of school for a semester, ended up going out to San Francisco, spending a year and a half there, then getting in a fist fight with a guy I had borrowed money from his girlfriend and didn't pay her back. I was in a blackout, so I actually didn't know that. And he came by the office to collect. We got in a fight. Of course, I got fired from that job. It was this great job. The company's still around. And I was like, you know, at the time, it was like 1999, so it was pre-IPO. So we all thought we were going to be rich. And then I just got ignominiously fired. And so went back to school and was still, so I was just starting to get a sense that drugs and alcohol were a problem. But I continued kind of trying to wrestle with it myself for a couple of years until that first internship on Wall Street when, you know, during the first month of that internship, that girl dumped me. And for whatever reason, that was the moment that I, you know, surrendered and said, you know, I can't do this anymore.
and okay, transitioning out from there, at what point did you become dead certain Wall Street was your gig, your future? I know you mentioned Liar's Poker.
Yeah, I mean, I knew it was going to, I wanted it when I read Liar's Poker, but it was really like when I walked onto that trading floor. I mean, if you can imagine, like, you know, I grew up in Glendale, which was sort of like middle class, and we were on the lower end of that. And so there was like, there were wealthy people around, but wealthy meant having like a nice convertible, not, you know, Wall Street wealth. And then I went to Columbia, and I started seeing these people with real wealth, and sort of seeing the kids that went to Harvard, Westlake, and Andover, and Exeter, and like understanding that there was this class, and that the lives of those folks looked different than the lives that I had grown up in. And I remember once I started dating that girl, and she came from that world, and we went to visit a family friend of hers, and he was this big Wall Street lawyer. I think at Simpson Thatcher, and he was a partner, and he had a townhouse in New York, and we went into it, and it was literally like walking into a different world. And I was like, oh my God, like, I can't believe people sort of have a life that looks like this. And then when I walked onto that trading floor for the first time when I was, you know, 22, and it was CSFB, and it was just this huge trading floor, and I could just see the traders all over the place. And like, I don't even know what it was specifically, but they all looked like that guy did. I mean, maybe it was their haircuts, maybe it was the clothes they wear, the loafers with no shoes, you know, whatever it was, the khakis, the whatever. But I saw that these guys, everybody on that trading floor looked like this guy who is that Wall Street lawyer. And I was like, yes, this is what I want to do.
How tough were the first few years, 100-hour weeks?
I mean, the first few weeks was like, you know, I'm a guy that has never, I mean, actually now I'm okay with it, but like I had never been able to sort of fit in socially anywhere. Like I was always sort of insecure and in my head and self-conscious.
You think you didn't fit in because you think you didn't fit in? It was an internal thing?
Absolutely.
Short answer, were you popular in high school?
No. I was desperate.
Really?
I was desperate to be popular, but I was definitely not. So I was like, you know, I grew up a chubby kid who was really smart and also spoke to people like my dad spoke to me, which was with a lot of harshness and sarcasm. And so, you know, I could make enemies way quicker than I could make friends when I was a kid. But I started to, like, when I was a junior when I was in junior high school, I would just watch the popular kids and be like, God, I want to be one of them. And then when I got to high school, I really started actively trying to do it. So I was really like trying to make myself into this guy that would be popular. So I figured out how to dress a certain way, how to, like, you know, talk to people. I started showing up at parties. I, you know, got good at wrestling, and like was always sort of had this eye towards kind of breaking into that popular group, but really did. And so when I got into the CSFB thing, it was sort of the same. All I'm saying is, like,
Hold on. For those on the call that don't know what that is, if you want to just give up.
Oh, the CSFB?
It was
Credit Suisse First Boston is one of the top investment banks in the world, and I had pulled a summer internship position, which meant, you know, 2 months working on the trading floor. And for me, it was on the corporate bond desk and then the mortgage sales desk.
Mm-hmm. What did you major? You majored in economics at Columbia?
No, I started out as an economics major, but by the time I got kicked out of school, I had like, well, first of all, you didn't have to declare your major at Columbia until I think the end of sophomore year, but I was planning on doing economics, but I was not very good at it. And, you know, as you could tell from my 3.3, like when I didn't have interest in something, I would just completely fail at it. And so, economics, I was, you know, by the time I got kicked out, I think I was below a 2.0 GPA. And then when I got back to school, I was just, you know, I had been fired from that job in San Francisco. And so I was just desperate to, like, you know, make it work and see if I could possibly graduate. And so I had always been a huge, voracious reader. And so I said, oh, well, the thing I know I can do best is read books. And so I majored in English.
Okay. Fair. Okay. So you finished up at Credit Suisse.
Yeah, well, so, I mean, the part of the story is, like, that first, you know, the first couple of weeks at Credit Suisse were tough, but I was like, I was so ambitious. I was the first one to show up at work, the last one to leave at night. I'd go out with the other interns or to, like, you know, events with traders, and was just sort of desperately trying to ingratiate myself and impress people. And, you know, I was getting coffee and everything was, that was my life. But I also had this girlfriend who had taken the semester abroad in Italy and then had come back. And so things were sort of on the rocks, but we were sort of together. And so she broke up with me in the middle of that summer. And literally that's when my life changed, because for whatever reason, her breaking up with me was so devastating that I couldn't even go to work. I went to work the next day and couldn't make it through the day. So made up a lie, or not made up a lie, but asked a woman to cover for me and left. And that was the day I kind of admitted that I needed help and called this counselor. And, that was the last day I ever drank. And that was 11.
So you haven't had a drink, drugs, nothing in 14 years?
11 years.
How did you get through? I mean, that had to be pretty tough, getting through Wall Street life without drugs or alcohol, right?
It was incredibly tough.
I mean, isn't that like, once you're done with the 100-hour weeks, I mean, isn't that the entire gig, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, the Hamptons during the summer? And
I mean, honestly, it was one of the hardest things about it. If you can, and I'll tell you a story about Michael, that sort of moment that I sort of realized that guy was different. For those who don't know, on the call, Michael is my mentor. He's on the board of Grocery Ships. He spoke at my wedding. He's like a father to me. And he was my first boss when I started real Wall Street, which was after college. I got a job at Bank of America. But to your question, like, yeah, when during my internship, it was everybody was saying, you know, Wall Street works hard, but we play harder. It was clearly part of the culture to be, you know, good in a bar and know how to handle yourself with booze and be good with girls and everything like that. And when I got sober, first of all, that the rest of that summer internship was a complete disaster, because I was so sort of depressed from this girl that, like, my ambition was sort of gone and I couldn't really do much good at work. And so I ended up not getting a job offer for that. And then I went back to finish my last year at Columbia. And when I got, I got a job at Bank of America and started. And when I started at Bank of America, I had been sober for a year. So I had, like, dealt a little bit with what it was like to be sober. But again, I was placed in this position where I was trying to, you know, impress these new group of traders. And to what you were saying earlier, it was all about drinking and partying. And I was so insecure. I didn't tell anybody that I was sober.
How did you get out? How did you even, I mean, I'm thinking about all my friends that work on Wall Street. I couldn't imagine if I showed up to wherever they are and, do you want to drink? And I said, no. I mean, for me, it's easier. I'm older. I said, no, I have a meeting in the morning, can't drink. But you can only tell that lie so many times.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you what happened. It was, so for like months, I was like sort of freaking out about this and just kind of existing under the radar. And then one day I was out with all these traders and we were at a bar, and this guy that I never liked, who always made me get his lunch, and he was this kind of like, I don't know, I just didn't like him. And he it was one of those moments where he like called across the bar and he's like, Sam, what do you want to drink? I'm going to buy you a drink. And the whole bar went quiet and I was like, Diet Coke. And
Oh, brutal.
And he was like, oh, let me get you a real drink. And I was like, no, Diet Coke. And so it was this terrible moment. And so then I walked up to get my drink and he like pulled me aside. He's like, do you not drink? And I was like, I don't. And I just knew that it was like out. And I was like, so sort of embarrassed. I didn't know what was going to happen. And Michael, my boss, wasn't there that night. And so the next morning on the trading floor, people were clearly talking about this. And so Michael heard people talking. And so in the middle of the whole trading floor, he stands up. He goes, and Michael, I don't know if you know this, but is like a legendary partier, like out 7 nights a week, known across Wall Street as one of the biggest, you know, partiers, one of the guys with like a million friends. His voicemail is always full. And so he stands up in the middle of the thing and goes, and I don't know him very well at this time. And he says, shouts, you know, Sam, is this true? Do you not drink? And I just stood there and everybody kind of looked at me and I said, I actually didn't say anything. And then he stopped for a second and then he motioned me over to him. And so I walked over to him and like squatted down next to him. And he looked at me like really intensely and he was like, is there a reason that you don't drink that you don't want to tell me about? And I said, yes. He said, okay. That was it. And from that moment on, he had my back. And so all of a sudden he made me his junior guy like a couple weeks later. And when I would talk on the phone all the time, he would take me for walks, just the two of us. And honestly, that was the beginning, that moment where like I was like effectively a teenage kid who was nervous about what people would think that I didn't drink. And this guy, like for whatever reason, had the generosity of spirit to respect that, not push me about it. And since then, you know, our relationship has only gotten, you know, better and better.
Great guy, by the way. Really, really nice guy.
I mean, like totally.
He seemed like a real, just genuine good dude. The kind of guy you want to, know, kind of person you want in your life.
Absolutely.
For sure. All right. So you were there at Bank of America for how long, and how did the tour go? And then how much longer after that did the nonsense begin? By the nonsense, I mean just blowing, lighting money on fire.
Yeah, I mean, it was like, you know, I think my first year I made $40,000 was my bonus, plus like a $55,000 salary. And, you know, I was like, I actually got a trading position. I started actually trading a book 8 months into my career, which was really fast. I just got lucky because a bunch of people resigned and Michael gave me a good seat. But I was still in the analyst program. So my second year I made like $75,000. My third year I made $125,000. And then it started really taking off because I was now trading credit derivatives and I was trading the telecom sector, which is a really big sector. And I was in Charlotte in the beginning and moved up to New York and started trading just way bigger size on a way bigger stage. And so then, and it was also, you know, I don't want to blow smoke about myself at all. I mean, it was this crazy time when, like, you know, I had been trading really for no more than 9 months when Citibank, no, not 9 months, trading telecom for no more than 9 months when Citibank called me and offered me, you know, $1.75 million for 2 years to trade their telecom book. But I actually didn't accept that job. I went, and the first thing I did was I went and told Michael that they had made that offer, and he helped me sort of leverage that offer into a move to the distress desk, which was, I don't know if you guys, a lot of people on here are like, you know, Wall Street people, I guess. But distressed, to me, distressed was like the Navy SEALs of, you know, bond trading. It was like the, you know, top, and that's where I wanted to go. So I got a job on the distressed desk, and at that time I was like, you know, throughout those years, it was like your sort of like standard Wall Street stuff, where it was like, you know, black cars waiting for you at the airport that brokers would arrange, and you know, anytime you wanted to go to Per Se or La Bernardin or Nobu, you know, there, nights with clients, you're out with clients at dinners every night. You know, I was living in the West Village, and then I was dating this you know, really nice woman from who worked in fashion PR, and we moved in together in this like $6,000 a month, you know, Bond Street apartment that I always laughed because it had like two living areas. Like it was this huge, like, what do you call it? Like a loft, but we had like two sort of living room sitting areas, which like when I sort of realized how sort of crazy I was like, why did two people need, you know, two sitting areas? But it was just so big, you know? And so that was, you know, I was at Bank of America for, I think, from 2003 to either the end of 2007 or the end of 2008. And then I moved to a hedge fund, a really big hedge fund.
Did you, what happened with you internally and results with women? Because you're saying you weren't so cool in high school, right? You weren't necessarily comfortable, and now you're making quite a bit of money, and you're being taken Per Se and Nobu every night, except I'm guessing the no drinking was a bit of a setback, right?
Yeah.
Partying, women, et cetera. So what happened then? Was in your mind, was it just sort of a bunch of fallout female attention, or did you feel you had really internalized and made a transition and established some confidence through this entire process?
Yeah, I think it was both. I mean, for one, like the, you know, I say I wasn't good with girls, and that is true. But, you know, the girl that had ended up dumping me when I was at CSFB was like, you know, I had no idea how I got her, but she was like, you know, amazing, like gorgeous. I thought she was the hottest girl in school for sure. And so how I sort of managed to get her, I don't know. And then when I lost her, I was like devastated. And so then in the years that I was in Charlotte, for whatever reason, the sort of limited game that I had developed in New York, did not play at all in Charlotte. And part of that was just being, you know, sober for the first couple of years. And like, you know, I remember the first time I actually went up and like had the courage to go talk to a girl when I wasn't drunk was like, you know, I was at this bar with a bunch of sober guys that I was hanging out with. And this girl was clearly making eyes at me. And I like, it took me probably like an hour and a half to finally get up the courage. And by that point she was like, she had like separated herself from her friends. So she was like standing by herself looking at me, and I still, you know, couldn't get it out, get enough confidence to go do it. But I did.
It's not very common in the college athlete realm, right? There's a certain degree of confidence that comes with playing college sports and just that whole society.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. First of all, let's just, you know, call a spade, which is that wrestling is not a very cool sport.
Yeah, it's definitely not basketball, football, baseball.
Right. It's not, or soccer, but also, look, I mean, the truth is that I sort of never really felt like, I sort of, like, wore the accoutrements of the position that I was in, but I actually never felt like I filled it, is really the truth of it. Like, I was a college athlete, I was a Columbia wrestler, and I held that out as a badge of honor, but inside, I felt like I wasn't good enough either to be at Columbia or to be on the wrestling team, and I certainly, you know, didn't feel confident that my social skills matched that of my position, you know. But then, you know, as the years went by and I got kind of, you know, one thing that we haven't talked about, but is, you know, in my, you know, in the years after I started talking to that counselor, I would talk to her every week. And the sort of stuff we did to me seemed really bizarre. We would talk a lot about my childhood and my parents and kind of feelings that I had from back in those days. And, you know, we would also like talk about, you know, how I was treating people now and what that looked like and how I could be accountable for my behavior. And all that is to say that, you know, I didn't really realize what was going on then, but over the years I was building up this sort of like inner sense of, you know, for lack of a better word, character. So I would learn to speak with integrity and honesty. And so that is to say that like I was sober, but, you know, 3 or 4 years in, I just started, you know, sort of like what you're talking about, but feeling comfortable enough in myself that I didn't, you know, could let go of that idea that, you know, how much you drank was how much of a man you were or how cool you were. And I could just say, you know, this is me, this is who I am. And so, you know, by the time I started dating that blonde girl, her name was Victoria, she was, you know, she was one of those girls that I would have thought was out of my league in high school. And I was sort of, you know, upfront about, you know, I'm sober and, you know, this is, you know, I have this sensitive side and I talk to a counselor every week, but I still sort of felt a little bit more enough than I had felt in the past. And I definitely think that helped with women. And, you know, as we get later in the story, I can tell you that it even changed even more.
I couldn't imagine, first of all, living in New York, not drinking. Secondly, working on Wall Street and not drink. The drinking culture in New York is just so over the top. It's unbelievable. I mean, when I first moved there a few years ago, and I split my time now, I was blown away by how much and how frequently people drink in Manhattan. It's crazy. I don't know another city like it. That's sort of what you do at night. You drink alcohol. Okay, so that led us to where you were Soho with that girl. I can't remember directly. You guys broke up.
I broke up with two
off topics. One, has the internship girl, do you have verification that she has read your story?
No, I have no idea. Although I can't imagine she hasn't.
What's that?
I said I can't imagine that she hasn't, but
yeah. No, and number two, how's the relationship with your father? Because obviously, you know, using terms and all the rest would lead people to think there might be a large divide between you two now.
Yeah, there is. Although I don't think large divide is sort of like the right term. So my dad, you know, one of the processes that we went through in counseling with this counselor is I started sort of doing these counseling sessions with my parents, which was pretty much one of the more gnarly things that I'd ever done. But I would literally go in and say, you know, Mom, when I was a kid, you know, you treated me like this, this, and this, and I'm just here to tell you how it felt, and that's it. I did the same thing with my dad, and, you know, we would just do these over and over. And, you know, my mom and I went through this really intense process doing it, and, you know, we had a lot of difficult times doing it. And one of the things that she did was took sort of accountability for some of the stuff that she'd done. And, you know, like anything, like, you know, once somebody takes accountability, it's easier to move on. My dad was a little bit of a different, harder nut to crack. He's a guy who, sort of my whole life, I don't know if he ever admitted that he was wrong on anything. And so he would always just like kind of come back with different reasons for it and different explanations. And that was sort of fine. But it, you know, long story short, with my dad, the relationship over time sort of, you know, for lack of a better term, you know, I kind of realized that like being in relationship with my dad was really difficult. And then we had this whole thing happen in like 2006. And then, we pretty much, he and I stopped talking then, and we haven't, we like exchanged text messages now and again. But we haven't really sort of been in relationship for whatever 2006 is. So about 8 years.
Oh, wow. How, and now another off topic, how do people react just sort of, you know, like the way you speak is, you understand the way you speak is not typical, correct? When I say the way you speak, you're sort of emotional, radical honesty, right? Most people don't really speak the way you do, right? Like,
yeah.
I've heard someone say, I haven't been in a relationship with my dad in a while. Robbie and I were laughing about this. Robbie, you're still there. You unmute. Robbie and I were dying laughing about this with my dad about, oh, I don't know, maybe 6 months ago. There's a much different way you speak to, you know, your mom, the relationship between mothers. Hey, I tell my mom I love her all the time. Bobby, what was the joke they were making? I said, if I was doing something and called my dad, say, hey, I just want to tell you, Don, I love you, he would know for sure that I had been kidnapped and it was someone else, right? He's, you know, a 6'2", you know, high school football star, very macho guy. He did not have that relationship at all. We get along really well. We're best buds. But there isn't much I love you.
Yeah.
So how do people respond to, I don't know what you call the way you're speaking, with lack of a better term, emotional radical honesty?
But look, I mean, the short answer to your question is, like, I think one of the reasons that the article went viral was because I was so open and honest about how it feels inside. And for me, it's just, it's really important to do that, because I'll tell you what, man, there were so many times in my life that, you know, when I was, you know, sitting on the wrestling bench and, you know, just being so insecure and in my head, that if somebody had just come in and kind of spoken as if they sort of had a sense of what I felt like, if they were sort of spoke and sort of put the guards down and said, look, this is the truth for me, this is how I felt. And, you know, I think one of the things about my story was, there was a Wall Street guy coming out there saying, like, look, I felt insecure, I felt envious, I felt jealous. And, you know, I know there's been varied reactions, and I've gotten varied reactions, but majority of reactions, people writing and saying, you know, I really identify with you.
Mm-hmm. You said, well, I guess we can just return back to Bond Street.
Yeah. So, you know, that was sort of like, by that point I was like 5 years sober. And I was, I just had made this move to this hedge fund. There was this moment with this girl where I just was kind of standing with her and just realized, not only did I sort of really not love her, even though I was living with her, but that I didn't think that she actually liked me either. And there was this moment where I sort of realized that these sort of outsides of my life didn't match the insides of my life. And so that was right when I moved to this hedge fund. And so it was really this crazy time, because I really started to own this sort of thing that had been developing inside me, which was this sort of like sense of who I was, for lack of a better word. And the sort of sense that, you know, who I was had nothing to do with kind of what job I had or what my apartment looked like or how much money I had. And so I broke up with that girl. I moved into a really small apartment and sort of started like living like a much more modest lifestyle and sort of saving money and starting to like just let in the thoughts of what it would be like to leave Wall Street, which for me, and I know it sometimes can sound crazy, but for me, it was honestly the scariest thing to contemplate in the world. Because walking away from Wall Street didn't just mean walking away from money, or, you know, this future that would lead me to power, but it meant walking away from my identity. And, like, you know, it meant walking away from a belief system that I had had my whole life, which was that, your value is based on the quality of the institutions you're associated with and how much money you have in the bank and what you look like on the outside. And so that's why it was scary. So anyway, so I went to this hedge fund, and to me, this job, you know, within a year in the hedge fund, I was named the, you know, head distress trader, or at least the senior distress trader. There was two of us. And to me, it was like for the first time I'd reached this point in my career where there was sort of like nothing above me, meaning that there was definitely a head of trading and the portfolio managers who were like huge guys, but I wasn't going to be that in the next 3 or 4 years. And so I was, had sort of like felt like I'd kind of arrived at where I wanted to be in terms and professionally. And so that was incredible. But at the same time, I was sort of dealing with this inside stuff, which I was starting to realize, like, gosh, you know, like I still feel like I don't have enough money, even though I'm making millions of dollars. And I'm not sure I really like feel like, you know, moving derivatives around is really a what I want to sort of do with my life. And I remember, like, I started to volunteer right around that time, and I went to an event at some, you know, thing for a charity that helps children, and this woman came by, and she was this white woman, probably about 30 years old, so probably about my age, and she ran a charter school in the Bronx for kids aging out of the foster system, and she was, I mean, she was just electric, you know. She probably made $40,000 a year, but she, like, knew what she was about, and her life was, like, about helping these kids, and that was her role in the world. And there was just something about that that I was like, man, you know, like, I guess for the first time my, like, definition of success started to change. You know, I remember once my counselor, like, years into my Wall Street career, she asked me what my goal was, and I actually didn't even know and when she finally asked me, I was like, well, I guess it's to be the CEO of the investment bank or a you know, billionaire hedge fund manager. But I hadn't even really thought about, like, what I was doing. I feel like I was just going along this path, which said prestige and power and money are the most important things. And what sort of Latin, you know, it says on your degree, and what all these sort of like signifiers of power and accomplishment in the world, that's what I wanted. And for the first time, I started to like, I saw that woman and I was like, oh, wow, you know, the world doesn't sort of recognize her as anything particularly special. But to me, she looks special. She looks like she's sort of doing something powerful with her life. And even more, like, she looked like she knew it. Like, she looked like, it looked like almost like she had had a choice with what to do with her life. Oh, I remember that about her. She was a lawyer. She'd been a corporate lawyer, and she left that to do this. And I was like, wow, she made a choice to do something different with her life. And I just remember respecting that. But that was years before I was able to leave.
Okay, and so this is taking us to around when? 08, 09, probably?
Yeah, this was 08 and 09, and that's when it started to like get crazy. I mean, I remember this one moment where, like, I mean, the craziest thing was like, okay, you know, in the front page of the New York Times was like, not only was like Bear Stearns going down and Countrywide was going down, but then all of a sudden, like, the headline popped up on the NewYorkTimes.com that Elliot Spitzer was the head of a prostitution ring. I was like, what the fuck is going on with the world? You know what I mean? It was like the most like mind-blowing time where everything that used to be sort of unassailable was gone, you know? And it was a really stressful time on Wall Street, mostly because, I mean, we were all very scared. But even more than that, it was like, it was almost like, you know, what a rising tide conceals, you know, a falling tide reveals. And, you know, people look different, you know? So like my whole life, I'd thought that these guys, Dick Fuld or, you know, people at the top of the food chain on Wall Street, I sort of, Ken Griffin, you know, I thought that, I sort of believed that the more I studied and the more I learned about the markets, then one day I would be as smart as those guys and maybe able to kind of manage that kind of money. And, you know, everybody lost money that year. And it wasn't like, you know, I actually was up money that year, but it wasn't, that's not what made, it wasn't that I was like, oh, I'm a better investor than these guys. I felt lucky more than anything, but I really did see like, oh, maybe these guys sort of don't know everything. And for whatever reason, that was like a big deal to me to see like, oh, you know, maybe this whole belief that this is like a totally meritocratic system, that the higher you get, the better you are, the higher you get. Maybe that's not 100% true.
Earlier you said as the story unfolds, you'll see you're implying that some improvement with women had come along, or at least some comfort or confidence.
Yeah, so after I broke up with that blonde woman, or Victoria, in terms of like radical honesty, one of the things that happened was I like went through this stuff with my counselor where I like dealt with some issues that I had had with my mom and just some like anger at her that had sort of manifested in my life as sort of anger towards women. And as part of the sort of healing I went through on that, I gave up looking at pornography, which I had, you know, I wasn't crazy with, but I had looked at porn since I was a kid. And so I gave up that. And, you know, that was pretty difficult for me. And over the next few years, you know, I sort of like, for whatever reason, and I don't know if it was directly because of that, but something changed in me. And so, and also maybe it was, you know, growing up to be 30 in New York, you know, and, you know, I definitely think it's easier to get women when you're 30 plus than it was when I was 22. I had a little bit of money in the bank and all that. But for whatever reason, for the next year, it was sort of like I had always wanted it to be. I was just, it was easier for me to get girls. I was getting girls sort of, I mean, yoga teacher is a girl I ran into on the street one day. You know, it just sort of became like I'd always wanted it to be. But then I was like, at that point, I was sort of had this experience where I started, you know, messing around with a lot of girls pretty regularly, nobody I really cared about, and it was a lot of fun. But then I would have this experience where I would wake up, you know, the woman would come over and I'd hook up with her and we'd sleep together and then half an hour would be over. and I knew that she would sort of be there for the night. And I was like,
Oh, you're describing hell.
And I started like, and I started realizing that I didn't like that took half an hour and the whole night took 12 hours and I didn't want to be there. And that was crazy for me because it was sort of like, it was just another one of these fantasies that, you know, to me, I finally achieved and then it wasn't what I thought it was going to be. You know, I guess if truth be told, I used to think that if I could just sleep with so many women and all the time and a different one a night, then I would be happy. And then it turned out that I wasn't. And so I stopped and I stopped like messing around with women and I sort of like took a break and said like, okay, I'm going to wait until a real relationship comes along. And fortunately, within the next 6 months, I met the woman who is now my wife.
Would you credit some of that time sort of at least building the skills, whatever, the necessary social skills to?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know.
To land your wife, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't know what you guys believe about this. My sort of belief is that, like, if one is confident and authentic and confident in themselves from their own, whoever they are in a unique way, then that's going to be more attractive to women. And so by that point, I was just starting to own who I was with more sort of confidence and authority. And so even though I was a sober guy that was in counseling, I was who I was and I was proud of it. And I think that helped a lot.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So now you met your wife. I butchered the timeline. You met who's now your current wife. Pre or post quitting, we saw him, don't you, when you quit?
Yeah, right? No, it was pre quitting. It was about 6 months before I quit. And I'd actually, if you want to know the funny story about how we met, we had actually met a freshman year in college. I was at Columbia. My twin brother was at Cornell. I went up to visit him. He had a girlfriend. I started messing around with her best friend, which was this woman named Kirsten. And so I went to visit my brother at Cornell. I stayed an extra week because I was having fun with this girl. And then my brother and I got in a fight, and he learned that I had messed around with one of his high school girlfriends. And we got in a fight, and we didn't talk for 5 years. And so I had left Cornell immediately, went back to Columbia, never went back, never saw that girl again until 10 years or 13 years later, my brother had thrown he was staying with me. We'd since patched things up. He actually got sober 4 days after I did. And, we were good friends and he was staying with me that summer in Brooklyn. He threw a brunch. And so I came home during the middle of it. And in the middle of the room was this woman, Kirsten, who I had met 13 years ago, who, you know, is now my wife.
Oh, wow. How did you guys lose contact then?
Well, it was because she was at Cornell with my brother, and when he and I got in a fight, I never went up there again and never, called her again. Yeah.
That's interesting tie-in.